Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fuckstables, what the fuck Minster Fullers, what the fucking Ucks, what the fucking Navians, what the fuckerikans, what the fucksicans for my neighborhood. How are you? This is Mark Maron. This is WTF. What's up? What's going on? You all right? Hey. You okay, man? What's going on, man? What's going on with you? Hey, whoa. Relax. Just take a breath. Take a breath. Get hold of yourself. All right? Well, I don't want to sound condescending. This isn't tough love. Just take a breath, man. It's going to be all right. Okay. Just hang out, man. Just relax. Oh, God. Blow it out. That's what it sounds like when you blow it out. Yeah, if you're in your car, scream a little bit. It's all right. Hey, or look, you might be having a good day. Maybe I'm not talking to you. I think you know who I'm talking to. All right. I'm excited about today's show because I talked to David Lowry. Come on, you guys. David from Cracker. But more importantly, in my mind, maybe not his. But you know what? I like Cracker. But Camper Van Beethoven, those guys were the shit, man. They got a couple new albums out recently. And we talked about it a little bit, me and David. But I'm just excited. Because I'm a huge Camper Van Beethoven fan, and I'm a very big Cracker fan as well. And quite honestly, I love David Lowry's voice. Always have. I always say I have one of the great voices in rock music. And I was excited to talk to the dude. It's kind of interesting, you know, when you grow up really respecting an artist and, you know, you love their music. And then, you know, they come in here and it's like, hey, we're just a couple middle-aged guys talking about shit. But it was great to see him. I came into Camper, like, I think it was late, and it brought back memories. I don't know how much I've talked about this. By the way, I had a weird dream where my brother shot me with a handgun last night. I don't know what that means. I haven't told him about it, but it was visceral. And I walked into a room. I saw my brother. He was, he had a handgun, and he was pretty dead set on shooting me. And I was like, no, that wouldn't be good. I stepped out of the room. He fired it, and I felt like I'd been punched in the chest. And I looked down at my chest, and then I woke up. So I got to figure out what the hell that's about. I'm going to call my brother up and ask him, you know, why are you shooting me in my dreams? That's no good. But I've been having some fairly lucid dreams lately. Yeah, the dream. Yeah, sometimes I dream about the ex-wife, which is weird. Yeah, I don't understand that. I've not seen or talked to her in seven years or so. Nothing's really happening in the dream. It's just, we're just okay. It's just like she's there and it's like, it's cool. It's no sex, no nothing. It's just sort of like, hey, everything's okay. Oh, God, it's heartbreaking. What is going on with me? You know, it's like adjusting to sort of really, you know, being alone is not great. It's not great at 51. And I'm not feeling sorry for myself, but, you know, I'm trying to enjoy my life, which I am. I'm busy. We're back in the writer's room. We're writing the third season of Maron. We've had a tough start at it because readjusting to sitting in a room with six other dudes, compulsively snacking, looking at each other, waiting for ideas to happen. But we're way ahead of the game. We've cracked a lot of the stories. We're doing some pretty interesting stories. Some of them obviously tethered to my life. Others speculative. I'd like to call that speculative. You know, what might happen? What could have happened? What would happen if I put myself in this situation? That's the weirdest thing about creating Maron, the TV show, is that, as you know, we don't have an ensemble cast, and we have recurring guest stars, but that means all stories run through me. I'm the guy on camera all the time. because it's my show, but that's not an ego thing. That's not a decision thing. That's a budgetary thing. There's no real room for a second story, or what about that guy? Well, that guy's only on one episode this season. Or so it's really kind of extremely personal, and it all has to kind of run through my character. And getting back into the room was pretty daunting in a way, you know, because I had a minor meltdown. I'll be candid with you. I was like, haven't I told all my stories? But obviously I haven't. But the weird thing about it was that, you know, I'm looking back at the last year and about what's happened in my life. And it's sort of like, all right, so I've had a couple of relationships go wrong. I've continued to earn a living at what I want to do. But what has really happened? And then I got into that mode of sort of like, what am I just spinning in my wheels in the fucking mud emotionally? Am I just sort of like is the same thing happening over and over again? Have I closed my heart entirely to the possibility of love and connection? Stay tuned. But so what I chose to do is just, you know, suck it up. Man up, made myself some dinner. You mean I'm just going to sit here and eat dinner by myself and watch a movie by myself? Yeah, but you know, you got good movies, man. Criterion Collection just sent you a bunch of movies for making a list for them. Why don't you watch one of those fancy movies? Yeah, that would cheer me up. Okay, this one looks good. Fassbender's Fear Eats the Soul. Yeah, it's uplifting. So I watch a German movie. I'm feeling a little melancholic, so I'm like, I'll throw on a German movie about racism and love, you know, not connected to each other, but can love transcend racism, and can, you know, nationalistic racism ever be adjusted or erased? Can love survive? Can people accept each other? Not clear. Nonetheless, I learned by watching that movie in the state that I was in that there's a fine line in my mind between feeling sad and feeling German, but I don't know. That was the experience I had. I was in my car and this came to me, and I, you know, compulsively was like, oh, I got to write that down. But and this is sort of heartbreaking too. Jesus Christ, Marin, don't talk to yourself in the third person. I wrote just on a post-it, I'd rather hurt myself than be hurt by you. There's a lyric. There's a little poetry. That's a little sad couplet. Is that a couplet even? Yeah, sure it is. Why not? Pow! I just shit my pants. Old school. Just coffee.coop. Available at WTF Pod. Get the WTF blend. I get a little kickback on the back end. Is that how you say that? We'll get a little something on the back end. That sounds sexual. The back end. What's my back end? Yeah. Hey. All right. Camper Van Beethoven. Let's go back. Let's go back. Somerville, Massachusetts, say 1988-ish. I'm living in a house in Somerville before Somerville got cool, before it got gentrified, when it was just the kind of old working class suburbs with a lot of smoking people. I have very powerful memories. I was there when Dunkin' Donuts introduced the big one. So I used to get that big one regular. And I used to get jacked up on that. That's where that Jones started, right there in Somerville, waking up. I was there living in a house where they built an entire bank building next door. It felt like an earthquake every morning when they were pounding foundations into the earth with a giant drop, like a crane that just dropped a giant concrete like disc onto the top of steel girders or pieces to pound them like a nail into the earth at 7 in the morning back when I was still drinking. Yeah, not a great time. But in that house, there was Stan on the ground floor who had his own record label, Vanishing Point Records. He was also part of a band, but he was always down there packaging records, figuring out how to make his little record label work, figuring out how to make his band work. His band was the only band on the label, Vanishing Point Records. Then on the second floor, you had Kofi and Elaine. Kofi was, I believe, from Africa. Elaine was, approaching middle age. She was a lovely lady. They were together. Very interesting relationship. Elaine was sort of the den mother of the place. And then also in that hallway, there was a guy named Mark who was very quiet and didn't quite fit in, but he seemed like a good guy. I didn't get along with him. He was sort of more of a nerd professor type of Jew to my like chaotic peasant driven artistic Jew. Then further down the hall was Scott. I'm not going to say his last name, but he was a dick. And then upstairs was me. And who else was there? Oh, yeah, sometimes Elaine's son, Jason, was there. And then his buddy moved in, Evan. Evan was sort of this kind of groovy, attractive-looking dude. He was sort of groovy, man. He was very laid back. I had an appreciation for that guy. He seemed to have a sort of zen to him. I was like 25, 26 years old. These guys were significantly younger than me. I was living in an attic. It was blue. I was alone up there. And Evan had all this music I'd never heard of, and one of them was Camper Van Beethoven. I think I heard maybe, I don't know if it was Take the Skinheads Bowling or one of those early ones, and I was like, who the fuck is that? And he was like, it's Camper Van Beethoven, man. He talked like that, seriously. And I was like, I gotta have everything those people have ever put out. And that was when I got into Camper Van Beethoven. Is there a better story from that time on Cottage Ave in Somerville? Yes, there is. Yes, there is. I found a cat. That was my first experience with a cat. And I was dating some girl named Amy, and there was a cat living in a tire hub, like a wheel of a car. This little kitten that was all dirty. It's a dirty little orange kitten. We didn't know what to do with it, so I took it back to the group house. And I was like, I got a cat. I'm going to call it Mojo, and I'm going to take care of it. I took it to the vet. I got all its shots, and I love that little kitten. And the thing was, and this is, I assume this happened, and this is why I'm not giving last names, but the guy who sat in his room that was just filled with records and books, and he was reading about Hitler, this tall keyboard player that thought he was a fucking genius and worked at the record store. He was a pompous fucking nothing, this guy, a real douchebag, first class affected motherfucker, and I couldn't stand him. There was just nothing better than when Scott got a cold sore on his mouth and just picked at it till it became this large, gaping, open wound that was hilarious. Fuck that guy. Why am I so angry about him? I'll tell you why. Because I think one time when I had my Betamax camera in the living room and I was shooting some stuff and I left it in the living room, I believe Scott hawked it. Ooh, I said his last name. I believe Scott hawked it. Yeah, I believe he hawked it. And then I got this kitten Mojo, and Scott, the fucking lunatic, delusional bastard, didn't like cats. And I had the cat in my room. There's no lock on the door. And I think Scott let the cat out and then let the cat outside. And one time I come home and, you know, I'm like, where's my Mojo? Where's my cat? And I'm worried about it. And then across the street, there was some construction going on. And I get a knock on the door, and this big dude, you know, wearing a tool belt, he's like, this your cat? And I'm like, yeah. He's like, you better be careful with it. You better keep an eye on it, man. It was just out on the street. You know, I could take it home. My wife would love this cat. And I'm like, no, it's my cat. It's like, I love cats too. I'm like, that's cool. You're kind of going against type. But that's my cat. And then like within a week or two, it was gone. I don't even know if Scott killed it or he just let it out. Man, I got some shit to resolve with that dude. I just hope things aren't going well for him. That's wrong. That's wrong. I hope he's come to grips with himself and realized who he is and his limitations, and he's living a healthy life. But he owes me an apology, I believe, for stealing my camera and letting my cat out, if not killing my cat. Yeah, I wouldn't put that past that guy. Speaking of cats, Monkey and LaFonda, Fountain, not working out. Just this weird thing that they can't understand that makes a noise while they're eating. But I'm going to stick with it. I'm going to leave it there. I'm going to turn it off, and maybe they'll drink out of the thing when it's off, and then surprise them and turn it on so they'll drink out of the running water. That's all I want to see for my investment of $78 or so in a ceramic cat fountain. I just want to see them drinking out of it like a water fountain. I want that to happen. I want it to happen for me. I want it to have it happen for everyone involved. Okay? All right. That's my hope. That's my dream. That's what's worrying me. That's what stands above all else. I'm writing a show. I'm performing a new hour of stand-up. But really what's pressing is whether or not my cats will drink from that fountain. Now you know how I feel about David Lowery. Now we're going to talk to David Lowery. It was a pleasure to talk to him. I love this guy. I love his voice. Loved Camper Van Beethoven. That does have some new records out. And I also loved Cracker. I saw them together. Yeah, well, there was common members. But anyways, look. Let's talk to David.
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.
Lowry. You got cowboy boots.
Yeah.
I almost bought a pair. You still feel okay about them?
Yeah, because they're really comfortable, man. I mean, you can't buy cheap ones. That's the only problem. My father-in-law got me a pair of these, and I started wearing them again.
Yeah.
I used to wear them like back in the 90s and
right,
80s
me too,
all the
yeah.
time. And my father-in-law is like, hey, you know, hey, I got this pair of
what
boots
kind?
For you, Lucchese.
Oh, the good ones.
Yeah.
So he had already broken them in?
No. He bought them new for me.
That's fucking great.
Yeah.
Like, I'm on the cusp now. I mean, I was in Austin, and I'm like, can I do that again?
Well, you know what's funny is if L.A. is, the thing about L.A. is, you know, you have your coastal areas, you know, it's like a city state or something like that.
Yeah.
You go out to the Inland Empire where my family lives and stuff like that, there's plenty of people who wear these just every day.
Sure.
That's what they wear.
It's cowboy country out there.
It's like ranchers. And
yeah, people forget that's what the Los Angeles and California was built on.
Yeah.
Was fucking big
ranching and farming.
That was it.
I know.
And then these Jews came out of nowhere and built the dream factory.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
It's exactly.
Yes.
We're going to make something that'll accept us. We're going to create a fiction. But, I have been a huge Camper Van Beethoven fan for many years, and it's very much an honor to have you in here.
Well, it's an honor to be on your show. I've followed your career.
You have?
All the twists and turns.
Really?
And the podcast kind of blew my mind when you how you just you brought it back, man.
I don't know, man. We were at the edge of it, man. You've been there, haven't you?
Yeah.
The
edge of darkness, yeah. Of course. I mean, you have to reinvent yourself, or you have to relentlessly continue to do what you do and then just hope that everything just rolls back into alignment. Like the world aligns back to where you are,
That's true.
It's like one or the other.
Yeah.
So.
If you can't, like, I'm not one of those people that, like, if I'm going to try something else, it's just going to be me doing that.
Right.
It's not, I can't reinvent. I'm not David Bowie. I'm not going to, you know, put a new outfit on, try to sell that shit.
Right.
I can't be anything but me.
Right.
But I want to know some stuff because, like, you know, I was sort of fascinated with the whole camper undertaking. It was always a mystery to me. I think I came at it sort of late. I met a dude in Boston. He had dreadlocks. And he gave me my first camper record, and I'd never heard it before. And this was 1989.
Right.
So I was like, where the fuck are these guys from? Where did that... Well, let's talk about you. Like, it was a kind of music. I'd never heard anything like it before.
Right.
You guys were doing something that it just didn't sync up with anything that I quite understood. And I thought it was amazing.
Well, I think that has a lot to do with the fact that we didn't really come from anywhere. My father was in the Air Force, so I lived... My mother's English, so I was like...
She's English-English?
English-English,
like British accent English?
Yeah, well, she can go back and forth when she needs to.
So where'd you...
She's been in the United States for like... I don't know, since the 50s, but, you know, she goes back and forth.
What, did your dad meet her on tour of some kind, or...?
Well, yeah, it was called the World War II, but... It was post-World War II, actually.
He took a prisoner.
It was I guess you could kind of say a war bride, exactly, but that's usually the other side. Now, my father was in the Air Force, and he met her in Britain and, you know, in England, south of England in 1953. And see, the thing is to people in her generation, the gangster, you know how you go to England, they're like, wow, gangster hip-hop or something like that.
Yeah,
it's really cool, right?
Right.
Well, to her generation... You know, hillbilly music was, you know, so here's this guy from Arkansas, you know.
That's where your dad's from?
Yeah, you know, it's like, he's in the Air Force, he just listens to country music, which is like the gangster hip hop to them of 1953, you know.
Well, like Hank and...
Yeah, Hank Williams.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing. My mom, you know, is pretty good, or is, not so much anymore, but is a pretty good record collector. And, like, man, I'm checking out. She has like these like 78s of Hank Williams EPs and stuff wow. like that. I'm like, Mom, this stuff belongs in a museum. Like, right. Donate this stuff to the Library of Congress.
Yeah.
You know,
does she still have it?
Yeah.
It's amazing to see those old records. So, okay. Mm-hmm. So your dad's from Arkansas, but you know, weirdly, some of that British, not so much English, but Irish music made its way into country music early on.
Yeah, absolutely. That's,
like a lot of that pace.
Yeah, and I mean, it's a you know, that was, you know, country, bluegrass, all of that is very, you know, a lot of that comes from the British Isles,
yep.
and then it mixes with the African like yep. influence in the South.
It's amazing.
And that's how you get American music.
And you grew up
You always have those two strains
yep.
through all of it.
Yep. Did you grow up with the country music?
Well, yeah, because my mom was English and my dad was from Arkansas. So, yeah, that's what we listened to a lot. But they listened to a lot of rock and roll. I mean, I remember we lived in, you know, my father got transferred to all these places.
Where were you born?
I was born in Texas.
So you're Texan.
Yeah, and Texans kind of like being Jewish.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, even if you only live there for 3 years, they're like, you're a Texan. You know, so we go and play and like...
One of our own.
Austin.
Is back.
Yeah. Texan. Yeah.
David Lowry.
Texan-led camper van Beethoven. But it's like, you know, it's
well, you got
like,
the boots, you got the shirt.
I got the boots, I got the shirt, yeah.
So where'd you end up living? What were the sort of primary influences?
Well, we lived in Spain, and then, you know, my father got sent to Korea. We were living in Spain. My mom becomes more or less fluent in Spanish.
Do you?
What? In
you
Spanish?
Yeah.
Not really, but I can say the nouns of a lot of stuff.
Right, yeah. Sure.
I've pretty much only been attracted to Spanish girls or girls with who have some Spanish blood in them
for
most of my life. Yes. That's imprints on your brain in some.
How old were you when you lived there?
I thought I met a Southern girl,
yeah.
right? My current wife, she's a concert promoter. She runs the 40 Watt, right?
Yeah.
I thought I met a Southern girl, and then I was like, what kind of name is Valina? You know, it's like, oh, it's Spanish. Her family came from Spain, you know? It's just like, I can't escape it.
Well,
so
it's better to be compelled towards an ethnic disposition than some sort of craziness.
Well, I think, yeah. My wife isn't crazy.
Uh-huh. Good diplomatic.
My wife is not crazy, but as I am prone to point out to her, look, we're a teasing family. We say shit like this to each other all the time. That's how we stay together,
yeah.
okay?
Sure.
I'm always telling her, it's like, okay, so normal girl is here and crazy girl is right here.
Right.
It's just not very much, it's not too much different.
Yeah.
Because she was asking me, why do dudes date crazy women? I go, well, it's, you know, really not that much different when you put it on a linear scale there.
Yeah, but there's also the argument as you get older.
We're a teasing family, right?
Sure, she can take it. Right, but there's also the argument that once you get cynical, the other side of that is like, they're all crazy.
Yeah, yeah, that's exactly. That's sort of what I'm saying in a very diplomatic way, okay? And getting away with it, okay?
Okay, so, yeah.
Yeah, that's right, and that's that. So,
how long did you live in Spain? What were the formative?
5 years, like 6 to 11.
Oh, that's
something
important.
Like that. Yeah.
So right when you're starting to sort of like go boobs, you know, towards the end,
just like, about.
Yeah,
right. Yeah, just right about there. Yes, exactly. So that yes, that's
made the
that's
imprint.
Probably imprinted. That's probably what the imprint is in my brain, you know.
Yeah, so, Spanish boobs.
Yeah, so
where's that song?
Yeah, exactly.
And then, okay, so where you go after that?
We went to Southern California. This was going to tell you is my father gets transferred to Korea. So my mom is sent, he knows his next assignment's in Southern California, like out in the Inland Empire,
right?
You know, out by San Bernardino, Riverside.
Right.
He knows his next assignment's there. And my mom basically comes out and finds a house for us. My mom just kind of bought a house in the barrio.
Yeah.
In the Inland Empire.
So you're all
set. We were coming from Spain.
It's nice.
Like everybody spoke Spanish at home. She spoke Spanish, you know.
So she's like, this must be what this is here.
Yeah. And so we lived in Northside Redlands. And so it was a nice, slow transition for me from Sevilla, Spain to the Inland Empire. And, you know.
Did you do any conjunto tunes? Like, did she do any of that polka?
Well, we did do a lot of the Spanish. I mean, last album has, well, the one that we put out last year, La Costa Perdida, has like a straight up, I don't know what you got. It's generically norteño, you know,
those.
Polka,
oh,
Mexican polka,
with the horns.
No, not with the horns. It's just the more country style stuff. Yeah, you really should have an accordion.
But polka,
on it,
but polka,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's a two-step. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I listen to these, but I don't have the song list in my head. All right. So then, how do you end up in? Because where'd you meet the other guys?
Well, we started actually in the Inland Empire. Chris Mola and Victor and I were from there, and Chris Peterson, the drummer, was from Escondido, which is just really a fancy gussied up Inland Empire, really, ultimately. The three of us met there, but we immediately went away to college at Santa Cruz.
So that was it.
Yeah, and then that also is a, you know, that was a weird place. It was sort of like the hippies had left San Francisco and gone down to Santa Cruz, and then this weird, like, sort of technology, math, science kind of weird thing going on there.
Right.
And you had these really eclectic kind of, you know, punk hippie hybrid bands and like surf bands and, you know, so that was also important.
And that was all coming, that's all in like the first record. All of those influences are there.
Yeah, like the Norteño Mexican stuff, like the, and then, and you know, the other thing that we used to do is when we first started, we would play for all these punk bands. Like, I mean, we opened for people like the Dead Kennedys. And Camper Van Beethoven was a side band to our punk bands, right?
Yeah, I don't know. What was your first band?
My first band, well, I guess the first band that actually ever played out anywhere was a band called Sitting Duck. And it was sort of, it was, you know, some of the camper songs come from there, but it was definitely more punk rock.
Right. Fun punk rock.
Yeah, yeah. And then
we seemed to have a pretty good spirit about things.
Yeah, we had kind of
funny angry
songs. Yeah, know, yeah, largely not angry. So,
not publicly.
Yeah, and only in the dressing room. We had that, and then I was in something called the Estonian Gauchos. Pretty much was Camper Van Beethoven.
Right.
But we just changed the name to Camper Van Beethoven the next summer.
Where'd that name come from?
Camper Van Beethoven. Well, there's this guy, one of the founding members is this guy who, he's a really interesting guy.
Which guy?
David McDaniel. I mean, he really only plays in the first couple months of the band, but he had this really funny sense of humor.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody understood Andy Kaufman at the time.
Right.
But he totally did.
He got it. Right.
So he would do this stuff where he would make up these jokes that had all the rhyme and rhythm of a joke, but it never really made sense, right? It had all the pieces to it, and they weren't funny, but he would do these things, right? So that was kind of part of him naming the band, is like, oh, this is going to sound like it means something, but it doesn't, you know?
I mean, so now how does a guy only last in a band 2 months? What happened to that guy?
Well, because we moved to Santa Cruz, and we wanted him to come with us.
But from the Inland Empire.
From the Inland Empire, but he was very religious, and he felt like he had a calling to become a minister, and he did that. He's still a minister.
Really?
Yeah.
So he's not absurd anymore, or no, maybe he's more absurd than he's ever been in his life.
I'm not really sure. That he's pretty funny guy.
To go from Andy Kaufman to ministry, it's questionable, his intention.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know. That's a good question. But he seems sincere to me.
So on that first record, which was what, Landslide?
Telephone Free Landslide Victory. Sorry.
So who was the lineup on that record?
Okay, so that's Anthony Gass.
Yeah.
That's his real name. Which is funny because people go, what's your last name, Kevin? And he went by Kevin, too, for no apparent reason. He go, Gass. So there was Anthony Gass, Chris Mola, Victor Krumenacher, Jonathan Segel, and myself, David Lowry.
Jonathan Segel, the fiddle player.
The fiddle player, who, when we moved to Santa Cruz, then Jonathan Segel comes into the band, and this, you know, gets very interesting.
You met him down there.
We didn't meet him. We met him in Santa Cruz.
Right.
Not until we went to Santa Cruz did we meet him.
What was he up to? Because, like, he's sort of defining in the sound.
Absolutely defining. Yeah, that's the great moment is, because before that, we were like this kind of punk band, this
you
side
and Vic-
project to, Krumenacher, Mola,
Yeah.
Actually, you know, most
Victor's the bass player.
Victor's the bass player.
And the guitar player's name is, that's Greg?
There's also Greg Leischer, too.
Right.
Yes.
But he's the guy with you now, still.
Yes. He comes in on the second album.
Yeah, he's
it's
good.
It's just a bit, yeah, and it's just a big mixed up family. It's hard to follow all of this, but...
But yeah, I always wonder how that happens, though. Like, you know, because...
I never tried to talk anybody to stay in the band. That's how that happens.
But it almost seemed like a fairly like a some sort of weird communal 60s model.
It still kind of is. I mean, yeah. It's we more or less try to do stuff on consensus, although every once in a while somebody will seize control, like in a Thai coup d'etat or uh-huh. something like that, yeah. and mix a song differently than the way everybody else. You know what I mean? It operates more or less on a
because it seems like at least in the first few records that everybody was represented. That it's sort of like okay, we'll do that thing. We'll do your thing, and then we'll do this thing. And, you know, I mean...
It was our own record label, so we got to do that. We did whatever we wanted to, right?
So what was what was compelling about meeting Sagal?
Well, Jonathan played guitar, but he was walking around with a violin. Mm-hmm. We were at UC Santa Cruz, you know, go Banana Slugs. He was walking around with a violin, and so I walked up to him. I go, do you play that? He goes, well, I'm learning to play. I was like, perfect, because that was the point of the band. We were all in these other bands, and we were all learning different instruments.
Right.
Like, I was a bass player, but I was learning to sing and play guitar.
You came up doing bass?
Yeah.
And Victor, but he's a bass player, right?
Well, that's how I started. Victor was a student of mine, and he was my sister's friend. And
you were
I started,
a bass teacher?
Well, informally. It was like, my sister's friend wants to play bass. Okay, I'll show you how to play bass.
Right.
You know?
So you knew him when you were a kid?
Yeah. Yeah.
Like what age?
Oh, he was probably 15 or 16.
Uh-huh. That's a wild.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and right. I was in college, though, by then. So, yeah.
So, okay. So, Jonathan's like, yeah, I'm learning to play fiddle.
Yeah. And we're like, violin. Perfect. Hey, and by the way, we have all these fake Eastern European songs. Do you know how to play this kind of stuff? He goes, well, I am Jewish. So.
Klezmer.
Yeah. You know.
That's right. You do have those weird songs. What I'm trying to remember.
I think I can say this because I've been told I'm Mish. I always say this wrong. Mishpuka.
Oh, Mishpuka. Yeah, yes, yeah, yeah.
I'm told
your family.
I can say, yeah,
yeah, yeah
I
you
can
are.
Say
you're,
this.
Sure.
Okay.
I'll let you be Mishpuka.
Okay.
You're Mishpuka here.
Yeah, okay.
You mean like what songs are those? Like Vladivostok?
Vladivostok.
Yeah.
And I mean, it really was just us
the
sitting
Bala
in the
like Inland, a gap.
Yeah, we're just sitting in the Inland Empire. Go, what would Eastern European, what would Russian ska sound like? And the reason we played the ska songs was because we played with punk bands and they didn't like our hippie vibe until we played the ska songs. So we could get away with like three psychedelic songs until they were like about ready to kick our asses, and then we were like, okay, quick, play a ska song, you know, and play these ska songs and they'd love us again, you know.
That's where that came from.
That's the only reason it got into the set.
Appeasing skinheads,
appeasing, trying to keep our asses kicked. I mean, remember, this is the Inland Empire.
Sure.
You know, there's not like any irony there in that kind of like punk rock world.
Right. Is that where but you did Take the Skinheads Bowling was like, I would say arguably the first hit.
Yeah, it was definitely the
and
first
that,
hit.
But that wasn't on
it's
that
still
record.
Still the hit.
That wasn't on that record.
Oh, no, it is on the first record, Telephone Freelance Like
it
History.
Is.
Yes, it is.
Okay,
yes.
All right. So that was your sort of ironic, you know, shot over the, across the bow.
That's right.
For the people that bullied you.
Right, exactly.
Except ska music.
Except the whole point of that song was it wasn't really supposed to mean anything.
Right.
It wasn't like each line was supposed to like the line following was supposed to disrupt any meaning that had come from the line previous, and because everybody was so serious,
yeah,
you know, it's 1983. Everybody was really serious. We were all gonna like, you know, we were oppressed, man.
Yeah. Yeah,
we're gonna overthrow the man, you know. I mean, everything was so serious.
There wasn't an idea that you were gonna overthrow the man.
Well, not by the time we were in Camper Van Beethoven. I don't think
was
we
it the mid
80s. Yeah, it was 83, 84, 85 before we ever actually put it. That's the formative period. And then we put out an album in 85. So,
but that
yeah.
was like, but psychedelic at that time was
coming back.
It was for that first wave?
Well, barely, like right about the time. Yeah, you start having Green on Red and Dream Syndicate and Rain Parade.
But you guys went way out there. I mean, you're doing like old Pink Floyd covers and like some of this stuff is just chaos.
Yeah, total chaos.
Well, what can you just tell me? There's a couple things. Like I have weird favorite camper songs.
Okay.
Like I like the day that Lassie went to the moon a lot. And I like It's not on this album. That's not on the first album. I like Interstellar Overdrive, but I also like Surprise Truck.
Uh-huh.
And going into We Saw Jerry's Daughter. What is that about?
We Saw Jerry's Daughter?
Yeah.
We Saw Jerry's Daughter is about us literally seeing Jerry Garcia's daughter.
I knew it.
At just sort of walk. Somebody goes, hey, that's Jerry Garcia. I think we were in Eugene, Oregon, and she was walking down the street. Somebody's elbowing us and saying, hey, that's Jerry Garcia's daughter. It was somewhere in Oregon.
So that had to be what it was about.
Yeah, so I mean, that's Camper Van Beethoven. We just would write a song about that kind of stuff, you know, and like sort of have it done by lunch and recorded by, you know, dinner.
You did a Garcia cover on the first Cracker album or
the second Cracker
which
album,
which is one of my favorite songs.
Yeah, Loser. Yeah.
Right. What
Hunter Garcia's track. What
impact did they have on you early on? I mean, were they important?
God, you know,
because no one likes to talk about that.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, but here's
this
the thing.
It's like some guilty pleasure for rock guys. The Dead are fucking great.
Yeah, and we got to play with the Dead, too.
You did?
Because, it was pretty awesome. So, the thing was, is probably in 83, if you asked me if the Dead were cool, I probably would think about my sister by listening to some Dead with some Loggins and Messina and some other stuff, and I probably lumped it all together,
right.
You know what I mean? But by about 87 or 88, like, I was really getting it. And Jonathan Sagal had always been a Deadhead and had kind of turned me on to some good things and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And I remember the moment that I heard the song The Loser, because that's not on a Dead album.
Right.
It's only on a Garcia album.
Like the first Garcia album, I think.
And it's on a live tape. And I remember that my roommate had come home and he was totally drunk and he thought I was out of town, and he comes home and puts on the stereo and starts blasting this Garcia song,
right?
The Loser. And I kind of finally come stumbling into the bedroom. He goes, oh, I'm so sorry, I woke you up. I was like, no, who the fuck is this, man?
Yeah.
This is great, you know? And that was the moment, being woke up at 3 a.m, heard a Garcia song, but a Grateful Dead song. That was the moment that I got converted, you know, to the Dead. You know, it's like, wait a minute, I totally understand this now. You know what I mean?
So, well, I mean, like those studio records, the first few studio records, or at least like Workman's Dead and American Beauty and Terrapin and stuff. I mean, it's real shit. It's not.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, they put a lot of time in.
They just. Who was doing stuff like that then? And they were the ultimate DIY band. The other thing is, because, you know, sort of structurally, Camper Van Beethoven really related to the Dead. It's like, hey, they just kind of did it themselves.
Right.
They built this community around them. I remember, you know, we used to have this little Camper Van Beethoven newsletter, snail mail and stuff like that, you know, when in a lot of ways, we had our own label. You know, structurally, we were very similar, you know.
Right. And what, to explain,
although much, much, much less popular.
Right. But did you guys, you had to sort of, what would you call your success, you know, at the first four albums? I mean, because like I got to you somehow.
And we toured the world. I mean, we had a top five album on college radio, and I think Take the Skinheads Bowling did crack the top 40 in England, but. You know, I mean, it's some kind of success.
What's the song about LBJ pissing along the side of LBJ's Cadillac?
Joe Stalin's Cadillac.
I love that song.
Yeah.
I'm just going to sit here and be that guy. That was a great song.
Dictators,
man.
Of all kinds, you know, sort of left and right.
But that sort of shows your politics.
We were sort of anarchists, sort of, you know.
But when you were started out, the punk scene, were you in that world where, you know, you would sort of go do gigs at the behest of fans who would set you, like, I've talked to guys who started in punk, and, you know, a lot of times when punk rock, you know, popular punk rock bands, they just hire locals to open for them. Were you sort of that guy in San Francisco?
Well, a little broader than that. You know, we had a fan at one of the guys who was one of the, I guess you'd call him an executive. He was one of the executives at SST Records.
Right.
He was the promotion and publicity guy, was a big fan of ours, and or a real believer in us, and he would hook us up with gigs every once in a while. I knew the Meat Puppets, not through that world, but just incidentally, because I went to college with somebody they went to high school with, right? And that song History of Utah is sort of about the Mormon Deseret Empire, or whatever like that, but it's also about the two Meat Puppet brothers,
Kirkwood,
Kurt and Chris. It's sort of about them, because I knew this guy, Chris, and he was friends with them. And I went to visit them and his family in Phoenix one time. We hung out with the Kurtwoods, and they were off the hook, man.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just they were out there, man. You know, so we got shows with the Meat Puppets.
Did you drop some shrooms and go out to the desert?
I think we were doing a little more. It was a little more like vandalism that we were doing. I think we were more drunk and stoned and committing some vandalism, which I'm not sure what the statute of limitations are probably so, over with by now. But
I guess that makes sense because you know the Meat Puppets sort of come from. The Butthole Surfers idea of like, because you talk to Kirkwood and he's not willing to sort of classify the type of music they do.
Right, exactly.
And I think Camper does that as well.
Yeah,
you're hard to classify, which in the music business, it's like, well, we can't count on you to repeat yourself. So I don't know if we can get behind this.
Right, exactly. It's a difficult thing that, yeah. Well, except that, you know, we did eventually sign to Virgin, which was a major label, and they did have a history of signing these kind of screwball acts all the time.
But you guys, but those records are Beloved Revolutionary Sweetheart and Key Lime Pie.
Mm-hmm.
Those are still Camper records.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
It's not like you said, like, we got to reel it in.
Yeah, we need to put some big drums on this.
So yeah, right.
Yeah, you know.
What's the ones? What's this dude take and, the skinhead bowling over and over again?
Yeah.
In different forms.
Yeah. Let's get a dance floor hit of this.
You didn't buckle to that. And I just realized that record, not those records, but the Camper Van Beethoven self-titled record is like your fourth record.
Yes, that one is, yeah, that's actually the third, but yes. Yeah, we wanted to confuse people, so we just put out the self-title. Actually, we were following Led Zeppelin.
Uh-huh.
So isn't their fourth record the self-titled record?
Oh, was that the big one?
That's the one that everybody calls Zoso.
Right?
Actually, the third Camper record actually does have a title, but we didn't tell anybody what it was.
Right. It was just, what, it was two
it's
and
written
three?
There's two and three is before that. Written in the, remember vinyl, you could write things in the groove, the inner groove of the record?
Yeah.
Scratched in the inner groove of the record is Soviet spies swim upstream disguised as trout.
Uh-huh.
Okay, that's actually the title of that album. But
now I got to go look at my copy. We're going to go in after this, and you're going to show that to me.
Okay, yes.
Because I think I have an original pressing of that.
Soviet spies swim upstream disguised as trout, right? And that was simply because we used to get crazy fan letters, and somebody wrote us a letter saying, we dreamed your next album was called Soviet Spies, or I dreamed your next record. Maybe they did say we, which is even crazier, right?
Yeah.
I dreamed your next album was called Soviet Spies Swim Upstream Disguised as Trout.
Yeah.
So we go, well, that's
it.
That is actually the title of the new album. So...
And that was a big record for Camper fans.
Yeah, we had Good Guys and Bad Guys on that. We started to get on MTV a little bit.
That's a great record, man.
Yeah.
How'd that sell?
Well, you know, in those days, I think like if you sold, like you were an indie band and you sold like 25, 30,000 copies of a record, that was pretty good. Nowadays, you know, that almost puts you in the top 20.
Mm-hmm. So you guys sold that many records?
Yeah, 25 or 30,000 on our own label too. You know, and so
what was the name of that label?
It was called Pitch a Tent Records.
And which is the one that's you play backwards stuff? Is that Five Sticks?
Oh yeah, that's The Five Sticks is where we play along to another song backwards. We did that a lot throughout our career. We did that pretty much on every album.
How does that work? Was it a Zeppelin song or something, or was it your song? Did you do?
No, the first album I remember. Jonathan, Victor, and I decided to listen to it backwards.
Your first album.
And we were going, wow, there's some good songs on this backwards. I mean, we were the real deal. I mean, we really did take like mushrooms and smoke pot. I mean, we really did all that crazy. You know, I don't do any of that stuff, you know.
Yeah, anymore?
Anymore, and for quite a long time, actually.
Yeah.
Nothing. So,
yeah, me too.
Yeah.
15 years.
Yeah, so.
Nothing. Did you hit
nine
a wall?
9 years for me. Yeah. I have my...
So you're sober?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
That's
why I asked if we knew some of the same people. So,
we know all the same people.
Yes, we do know all the same people.
we're all the same ilk.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, what album were you on when that fucking came crashing down?
Greenland by Cracker.
Oh, really?
I was writing that album. That's why that album starts with the song that it starts with, so...
I'm trying to think that
it's called Something You Ain't Got. It's a cover song.
Uh-huh.
But I'd been like sober for about maybe 3 weeks or something
out
like
of your
that.
Mind.
And yeah, and I was like, yeah, and on tour with Widespread Panic, how does that work? And
you did it though. That's one of those great. Yeah. If you that's the first obstacle you get past sober, woo. You're like, yeah, I can do this.
Yeah,
I can do it.
Yeah, I remember we were in the Gorge in Walla Walla, Washington, or now near what? Where is that place?
That the place Gorge. where they have the
Sasquatch festival.
Oh yeah, man.
And there's a little town next to it.
Yeah.
And I remember we were in the hotel the night before, and I go, God, I better go find a meeting somewhere.
Yeah, you know.
It's like, so I found it, and I went over there and to a meeting. I was just sitting there, and one of the guys came over. He goes, he says, so what are you doing in town? You're not from here. I go, I'm playing Widespread Panic up at the Gorge. And he goes, why don't I come along with you for the next couple days?
I love that story. Did he?
Yes.
That's amazing.
I don't remember the guy's name or anything.
It doesn't matter.
Like, yeah, it was pretty awesome.
Those kind of things always choke me up. You know, once you've been in the racket long enough, you know, there's a narrative to things where when someone actually helps somebody out is very touching.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, what was great about it was... You know, the guy was really of modest means, just judging by his car. And
he
like
didn't know who you
stuff.
Were.
Not really. Yeah. Not until we went up there, you know. It's just,
did he have a good time?
Yeah, I had a great time.
And that was the Cracker. That was a later version.
Well, that was actually both Camper Van Beethoven and Cracker played those shows together. I'm pretty sure both played those shows together. It was Camper Van Beethoven had just become reformed.
The Camper Cracker tour. I saw that at Irving
Plaza.
Yeah,
and so we did some shows. Yeah, and so we did some shows with Widespread Panic. But anyway, the first song on Greenland is somewhere in that week there, somebody played me a song by this band called American Minor, a demo of theirs. And I heard this song. I was like, whoa.
Spoke to
like,
you.
Like a fucking kick in the balls.
Right.
And sort of, and you know, I don't know. And something really exhilarating at the same time.
And you had a cover.
Yeah, yeah.
You've done a few covers over the time.
Yeah.
You don't mind doing covers.
No, no, I don't, man.
Well, those two records you did with Virgin were great records.
Mm-hmm.
I loved them. And you brought a lot more to the production of those records.
Mm-hmm.
And that song, Jack Ruby, I love that song. You just made two big Camper records. And
then
Pictures of Matchstick Men, that was a great cover.
Yeah.
Why'd you decide on that one?
Well, this is when I was just trying to explain this to somebody the other day. This is when the music business was good, okay? This is when, and I don't mean like money-wise. I just mean like it was operated more in a fly-by-the-seat-of-the-pants kind of way. We put Pictures of Matchstick Men on that album because we had played that song apparently at some theater in downtown LA, and the vice president of promotion for Virgin Records, the first time he had ever seen us, he took mushrooms and he came to see us, and that was the first song we played. So for 3 years on Virgin Records, he's like, you've got to record Pictures of Mastic Men. I was so high when you did that song, right? I mean, like, that's the old music business. Like, there's those focus groups. There's no, like, you know, big-time producers being brought in and stuff like that. It's like, I don't know.
And you didn't mind doing the cover. You loved the song, obviously.
Well, it was a little controversial within the band to do a cover on that album because that album was so specific.
In what way was it specific?
It was just a little darker and a little more introspective and stuff like that. We actually recorded that song for Our Beloved Revolutionary Sweetheart, left it off, ended up redoing it to make it fit sonically in with Key Lime Pie so it could be on Key Lime Pie. But it was a little, that was a little controversial. You know, it was just like, it was just one of those things where we had the album minus Pictures of Matchstick Men.
It is a dark record. I'm looking at it now.
And, you know, just sort of when it got to the point where sort of like our manager, who was by no means a traditional rock manager. I mean, he grew up with us and he was a hippie dude from Oregon, you know. It was just like, no, by no means a traditional rock manager, not in any way trying to make us sell out.
Right.
Said, I think you need just kind of one happy song on this record. You know, that's when I knew, it's like, okay, all right. Because, you know, the record vice president of promotion had just been bugging us to do that for years. So, all right, let's just we'll have one song that's not sort of introspective and down tempo on the album. We put it on there. Thank God we did, because nothing else got on the radio. That was the only thing that got on the radio. So
was that your, but did you always think in those terms? I mean, I have to assume that being
you didn't think about being on the radio,
right?
But it certainly helped.
Yeah.
Once you did get, I mean, it, you know, you're just playing for more people, you know, and being on the radio for Camper Van Beethoven in those days, that meant, you know, you're talking about 30 commercial stations in the country. You're not talking about everywhere. You're talking about a K-Rock. That was it for alternative rock or modern rock. There's 30 stations, you know, and plus, you know, MTV could be pretty good too. So
went back in the day.
Yeah.
What, now, but that was it for a while for Camper. I mean,
yes, we broke up. We were in Sweden, and Jonathan had, we'd mutually sort of, well, no, we're not really mutually, but the four of us ganged up on Jonathan, and we decided that we couldn't really work with him on that Key Lime Pie record, and we booted him out.
Yeah.
It was a tough decision. Years later, he's back in the band. And I do have to say this. I mean, and he might understand this. There was no way we could have made Key Lime Pie with Jonathan at that time.
Why?
Because he wasn't in a good place to do that album.
Really?
He wasn't going to play less. He wasn't going to play, I don't know. I don't really remember what the arguments were, but
he didn't want to rein it in.
But it wasn't really like we were reining it in. We were just sort of leaving all this space in the album.
Yeah.
He didn't want to leave the space in the album. Fundamentally, there was also the problem that, you know, the record company clearly favored the songs that I was, you know, sort of being the instigator on. You know, when you write things collectively, there's always somebody though who's the real kind of tends to be the instigator,
right,
of the song.
But
and that sort of starts to become apparent to everybody. It's like, well, the record company likes his songs, and you know, I don't know.
So
you know?
They create band dynamics that may lead,
yes,
to bad places.
Yes. Whereas if we were still on our own label, I'm not sure that we wouldn't have also broken up, but there wouldn't have been like, you know, there starts being an outside sort of influence.
Sure.
You know?
But you wrote most of the lyrics?
I write most of the lyrics that I sing, yes.
Why did you, I forgot that you covered Oh Death, which is a traditional.
Yeah.
What was that about? I like the cover.
There's a band that is very much our predecessor from the Inland Empire, oddly, called Kaleidoscope. David Lindley came from that band.
He's trippy.
Yeah, and nobody really knew who this band was except for, you know, a few old hippies,
mm-hmm,
and this guy that worked at SST Records who was a big, you know, supported us.
Yeah.
And he said, so, man, you guys must be really influenced by Kaleidoscope. And we're like, who's that? He goes, you don't know Kaleidoscope? I mean, they're from your home area.
Right.
How do you not know Kaleidoscope, right? So he went to his record collection, made us like 3 cassettes worth of Kaleidoscope tapes, and
uh-huh,
and we went and listened to it, and we go, holy shit, this is kind of what we do. And one of the things is they cover that song Oh Death,
mm-hmm,
and we thought, oh well, we've got to do Oh Death now. That is just dark as shit, you know.
Yeah.
Like, and it fits kind of with what we're doing. Let's do that.
And you just saw yourself that, you know, after you listened to it, that, you know, whatever happened in terms of what was defining your sound at that time was what came about in earnest. But you realized that when you listened to Kaleidoscope, that there was a precedent for you know, where you were going. And there's no shame in that.
Right. It was just a mixture of, like, I don't know. I mean, they were doing this in 67, 66,
now
67,
I gotta go, 68 Now I got to go listen to them.
Yeah.
And obviously you guys were doing, you never got into that pigeonhole where it's sort of like, well, this is the Camper sound.
Uh-huh.
You know, this is the Camper system. This is the Camper.
Well, there is a little bit of a Camper system. It's mentioned, and it's in the lyrics. It's mentioned psychedelic drugs.
Yeah.
Some kind of oddball conspiracy theory and UFOs.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
But you know what I mean? It wasn't like there was not this massive hit record that you had to fucking chase for your life.
No.
Yeah.
No.
All right, so you guys break up, and it doesn't sound like it was a good breakup.
Well, you know, I think there was a writer for the New York Press who had the description of Camper Van Beethoven's that breakup that I always use because it is the most apt.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, he says something like basically that we didn't explode in this fireball like right. most bands, that we just sort of disintegrated like a urinal cake.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is kind of, like John, we sort of like, we can't do this album with you, Jonathan, you know, yeah. get out. And, you know, and then there was also the side band within Camp.
And I guess Beethoven, mainstream is, success was the stream of urine that was coming, dissolving you.
Yes, the mainstream.
Lack of mainstream success.
Yeah, yes. Or the pressures that those bring on you and stuff like that is the urine that's coming down. There's the Monks of Doom, which is, you know, the side band within Camper Van Beethoven, which tips it hat really heavily towards prog rock, you know, which was not really that cool at that time, but it was kind of underground and
but,
stuff.
But you weren't, were you in that?
No, I wasn't in that.
It was hard
so
for
that's
me to...
another piece. So they, that sort of was happening at the same time Camper was happening. And, you know, Jonathan did his solo albums and Jonathan goes off. Then we bring in David Immergluck, who had sort of played with Monks of Doom. He ends up, you know, we bring him in. Anyway, eventually the band, you know, the Monks of Doom guys leave Camper Van Beethoven, which leaves me with Immergluck and Morgan Fichter, who are essentially new to the band.
Right.
And I mean, I'm just like, we can't call this Camper Van Beethoven. You can't do that.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like the record company were like, you should just put another band together. You should do this, blah, 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 you know, just sort of gently pushing us back. Not like any bad vibe, high
right,
pressure
right, right.
things, but just like, you know, gently telling you should put together a new Camper Van Beethoven, you know.
But Cracker didn't turn out to be that at all.
No.
I mean, like,
to me, it was, yeah, right, exactly.
It was interesting because, like, I couldn't wrap my brain around Monks of Doom. I tried. It's just not my thing. And Cracker, the first Cracker album, I was like, holy fuck, because it seemed to me that you had the freedom to do more, you know, sort of traditionally structured pop songs in a way, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
And, you know, and it was rock. It was pretty right. straight up. Your right. voice is, you know, unique to the point where, you know, it's, you know, you can't deny it. I mean, everyone knows your voice.
Right.
It's great. And you were doing like, you know, pretty tight, just rock songs.
Yeah. Just straight up kind of
yeah.
3-4 chord rock songs, you know, and with my two buddies from the Inland Empire. Right?
Well, I knew, you know, Davey. I saw you at Slim's. In uh-huh. San Francisco, when I lived in Slim's, I probably touring on that first album.
You lived in Slim's?
No, close by. I didn't go there often, but I was right, a fan yeah. of that first yeah. record. And then years later, I met Davey. He
oh, okay.
plays with Elvis Costello now.
Yeah.
But I remember when he was playing with you, he was wearing a kilt, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I think it actually was a Catholic schoolgirl's uniform, actually. Well, yes, you're giving him the benefit of the doubt. Actually, I remember when Davey got that Catholic schoolgirl's uniform. We were in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and we were playing a place called the Art Bar, and across the street was a Catholic school supply place. And he goes, and he says, I'm going to go over and get a Catholic schoolgirl's uniform.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, really? I'm going to go watch this. We go in there. It's, you know, Baton Louisiana. I mean, I don't think we're in the Bible Belt. Maybe
yeah.
we're in the
crotchless
panties of
yeah.
the Bible.
The conflicted Bible Belt. Yeah,
yeah. And he asked for a Catholic schoolgirl's uniform, and the woman says, what size is your daughter? And he goes, oh, it's not for my daughter, it's for me. And she goes, oh, okay. And she walks up to the door, locks it, turns the sign around like it's an everyday occurrence.
What do you mean? Why'd she lock you in?
She was going to outfit him in a Catholic schoolgirl
uniform.
But she
didn't want anyone else coming in?
Yeah, she didn't want anybody else coming in, but she was perfectly fine with it. Like, it happens all the time. This is what I do.
This is
flip
protocol.
Flip the sign around, yeah. lock the door.
This happens.
This happens. It's the South. It's but Louisiana.
Was that the tour of that first album, though? Or
yeah, that was the first. Well, that was actually even before the first album. I think we did 2 weeks on the road. We just went down Highway 10. And to Jacksonville.
But so there you are. You do this band after Camper that's really your own thing. And that's
right.
the thing that pops.
Yeah, oddly. Just yeah. the right place at the right... Well, not even really the right place at the right time, because it's really rootsy. It's just that... And you know, I mean, you got to remember that was... That album comes out like 4 months after Nirvana's album or something like
right.
that, right? You know?
Yeah.
It's the height of grunge. And there's country songs on that record.
Oh, I
They're
know.
Like Rolling Stone
yeah.
style
right.
blues rocker yep. songs on that album, but we have enough tracks that fit with the modern rock format. It just pops, you know.
Teen angst pops.
Yeah, teen angst.
Yeah. yeah.
What and that the was world a, needs now. Yeah. yeah.
And that was a fun, great song. Had some heart to it.
Yeah.
Had good fucking build.
Right.
Yeah. And that
three chords.
And you charted
in the
with
opposite
that.
R. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we. I don't think it went. I don't think that album went gold at first. It might be gold now.
So you had a good run with Cracker. Kerosene Hat was great. I mean, I didn't realize you put out mm-hmm. as many records as you did.
Mm-hmm.
But at Greenwood.
Yeah, we're actually still making, we were actually making an album right now.
And how do they sell? I mean, how is your following held up?
Well, I mean, you know, considering we started 20 years ago, I think we're doing pretty good. I mean, we still play, I always joke that we've been playing the same places for 25 years. I mean, we're playing like we're not playing Slim's, but we're playing the Independent.
But now you're seeing people our age with kids.
Yeah.
That, right?
We try to play a lot of stuff that's like outdoors and in the day is what we do.
Right.
You know, because we get a lot more people than if we go and play in a nightclub.
But I have to imagine that given the nature of Camper and given the nature of Cracker as well, that you know your loyal fans are pretty decent people. And they probably have kids now and they come out yeah. and they're our age.
Exactly.
It's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it's interesting. Although, you know, Cracker's definitely had this little sort of revival over the last couple of years because of the film placements, right? Mm-hmm. You know, Perks of a Wallflower were pretty featured
which
in
songs?
That. Low is yeah. in that. That it's mostly Low is suddenly just anytime somebody wants to set the scene in 1993, bang, you know. But it, you know, it really has brought, you know, it's brought young people into our world. So, you know, I did this USO tour of Iraq where we did patrol bases.
And
Cracker did, yeah, in 2009, which is a pretty crazy thing we did. It was Memorial Day, might as well talk about it for yeah. a second. And, you know, one of the things that we imagined was, you know, you sort of imagine you could be playing for like these 21-year-old, like young, because we're playing patrol bases. I mean,
yeah.
We're playing in freaking Kevlar, right?
Yeah.
You know, just meeting these 21-year-old sort of like, you know, gung-ho infantry sort of kids of the grunts, you know,
yeah.
and the Marines and stuff like that, right, and everything. And so we were playing for them, you know, maybe we ought to play, you know, make sure we play pretty heavy on the rock and the fast stuff and
right.
everything like that. So we step out at the first base, right?
Yeah.
And this one looks the part and everything. Kid walks right up to me. He's like, "Are you guys Cracker?" I'm like, "Yeah, we're Cracker." He goes, "It's so awesome, man. Will you sign this for my parents?" My parents are going to be so excited when they find out that they saw you in Iraq, that you came to my patrol, came to my base.
Was that a big
this
moment?
Happened. That was the first thing that happened to us.
Yeah.
Like the
yeah.
first interaction that happened over and over again. And so we're like, so finally we're like, well, you know, this is actually cool. We're going over there and we're making the parents feel better. Which is patriotic, just as patriotic, and supporting the troops just as well.
Right.
You've got to support the parents back
right.
home, you know?
Right.
It happened over and over again.
That's
it was actually also though pretty awesome, though, because like the higher-ranking guys were our age.
Yeah.
And so we'd always get these cool things like, do you want to go and eat with the three-star general? You know, or like go sit at his table. Like, yeah, sure, we'll go over there. Yeah, you know.
But did you feel at all like that your personal politics were
well,
contrary?
Yeah, I mean, I was against the war.
Yeah.
I remember actually we were driving in this armored personnel carrier between these patrol bases with the same, it was weird, we had the same 16 guys with us from the 82nd Airborne. And these guys were with us the whole time. And at some point, you know, we're talking, there was way more of a frank conversation about what had happened in Iraq from USGIs than there were from Americans.
Right.
Okay. First of all, that was just the amazing mind
they knew
blowing
what was
thing.
Up.
Yeah. Just
yeah.
It was, and, you know, so at some point, we're all on these headsets. We're talking on the comms between in the little caravan that we're in. And I go, well, you know, most of the guys in the, you know, in the band and everything here, we, you know, we were against the war. And just one of the guys goes, no shit, you're musicians, man.
It's your job.
Like, it's no shit. It was never really an issue. And, you know, at that point, it was kind of the surge had happened. You know, it was like, you know, Colin Powell said, you know, if you break it, you
yeah.
pay for it,
right.
you know? So, I mean, what were we supposed to do? Pull out and let
right.
the whole...
No, I get it.
You know, if we were there, if we were there, going to be there at any point, it was sort of when, you know, we were trying to undo what we had done in,
well, you
in
grew
some
up in,
ways. And I grew up in a military family.
Right.
And so none of this is political in the same way it is to a lot of other people
who have
right?
this, who can't make the distinction between the realities of being an enlisted person.
Right, exactly.
And your job.
Right.
And the politics of the war.
Exactly.
Right. But having grown up with that, your dad was a career guy, wasn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, he was a career guy, but he was an enlisted man, too. So, yeah. You know, he didn't make any decisions about
right.
Right. Know, what Did we he, were doing. Or
was he in the Air Force the whole way through?
He was in the Air Force the whole way through. And he was pretty sick by the time I went to, he's passed away now. He was pretty sick by the time I went to Iraq. But this is an interesting thing. It's just my guy, here's my dad, and we're watching some news on the television during, you know, the invasion of Iraq, and they sort of have invaded. We've taken over the country, and then Bremer or whatever announces that they're firing, you know, they're disbanding the entire army and police and everything like that.
Right.
And my dad just stands up, and he's like, "What on earth are you doing?" Like, I mean,
right.
My dad stands up and says that.
And you're
what are you doing? You know, he's completely freaking out. It's like, this is you can't do that. You can't do that.
Yeah.
You know, this is coming from a,
sure.
And sure enough,
yeah,
I mean,
what
happened? It was a disaster.
Yeah.
I mean, I was sitting with my dad the moment that happened.
Was your dad proud of what you did? Did you guys have a standoff around, you know,
over
like,
the war? My dad was against the war.
No, but I mean, just as being the kid of a military guy, was there a period there?
No. Actually, it was awesome because he was like, you know, he was totally supportive of it. Whereas like some of the other guys that I would be in bands with or I knew in bands, their parents were very, you know, very, very middle class or upper middle class.
Yeah.
They were more concerned about it than my dad. My dad was always like, you can join the Air Force when you're 30. So if it doesn't work out, you know, you got a math degree, that's got to be handy somewhere.
You do have a math degree?
Yeah, I have a degree in math and math and kind of did math and computers and stuff. He's right. You know, it is actually kind of handy.
You have a math degree.
Yeah. Actually, I'm getting a doctorate right now, but not in math. I'm getting doctorate in something else.
What?
I'm getting a meta doctorate in the theory of higher education. So
how does that work? How does that come about?
Because I've been teaching like music business courses at a university, and basically I sort of look at universities and go, this is kind of a really expensive and screwed up way to educate people
in
some ways for some people.
Yeah.
And we should do something different. So,
well, I know you're sort of up in arms about how the music industry works and copyrights and publishing rights. I mean, you seem to be pretty pissed off.
I don't know if I'm pissed off as I like somebody's got to be the wrecking ball right now. Somebody's got to come out and say, hey, you know, in the old days. When a record label, okay, this is a great story, man. My mother-in-law and my father-in-law, you know the stories about the old bluesmen,
sure.
You know, or the early rock and roll guys, they would go down to the record company and go, hey, my song's on the radio, where's my royalty and stuff like that. And they'd go and buy him a Cadillac, which was worth much less than the actual royalties, right? So my mother-in-law worked for Sun Records and my father-in-law was a car dealer. How the fuck do you think they met?
Yeah.
I mean, that shit really happened, right? You know?
Yeah.
That shit really happened. So to me, like, I'm always been, you know, pretty pro technology, having coming from the math computer world. It's a long story. I remember building our first website in like 93 or whatever like that. It's like, I'm going to learn HTML.
Yeah.
And, but I guys got to the point where I just started going, well, you know what? You know, we wouldn't have put up with the bad old record labels paying us shit, so we shouldn't put up with this stuff.
And which is, what is this stuff?
Well, just, you know,
ripping off songs.
Well, no, just like mostly has to do with the rate. My real specific thing has to do with the rate that songwriters specifically are paid by these digital services. And in the old days, the performer. In the old days, back in my day, no, but really seriously, like on a download, on an actual sale, like the songwriter and the performer kind of end up with about the same amount. It kind of depends on the format and the label deal and all that stuff, right? But you go into the digital realm, and it was you get 14 to performer gets a, well, the recording gets about 14 to one what the songwriter does. The songwriter gets a lot less in the digital world, right? Huh.
And that wasn't the way, it was the opposite back in the old days. If you had the publishing, you had it forever. Well, you had the money coming in forever.
Well, yeah, in a lot of ways. And the reason this was done is because I believe there was a backroom deal cut between, I have no proof of this. This is just me putting on a tinfoil hat. I have no proof of this.
I like tinfoil hats.
Okay, I'm going to put on the tinfoil hat for a second. I believe there was a backroom deal cut between the record industry and the, you know, the beginnings of what became the webcasting and streaming industry is that one of the big expenses for record labels is having to pay the songwriter separately, right? Even if you're a performer, you wrote the song, they have to pay you a separate royalty.
That's publishing.
Publishing, right. So I believe that there was a backroom deal cut between broadcasters and what was the recording industry at the time, whereby they're like, let's push these royalty rates for the songwriters down because it's going to help all
of us. In this format.
Yes, on the digital format. So really specifically, it's fairly confusing to a lot of civilians what I'm specifically talking about, but I'm specifically talking about songwriters getting like, you know, sent a lot less. You know, that's where you get these royalty statements that are like 16 cents for, you know, 54,000 plays, you know, and stuff like that.
But,
you know?
But how was the voice of the songwriter not represented in this mythical backroom deal in the sense that...
Because the publishing companies are conglomerates. The big publishing companies are conglomerates.
Right.
With record labels. Like Sony Records has its Sony publishing.
So they're representing the songwriters, the publishing houses.
And but there are also the record labels, too.
Right. So they just did this deal without telling you
guys. Yeah. Essentially, I mean, and then there's another rationale, which is not tinfoil hat.
Right.
The second rationale that's part of that is that songwriters are paid when songs are broadcast on regular radio.
Right.
But performers are not.
Right.
And that is also totally screwed up. We're the only company... I mean, we're the only company. We are a company. Sure. We're not a country anymore. We're a company.
We're all our companies. Yeah. We're just individual companies.
We're the only country in the democratic sort of free world that doesn't pay the performers. We only pay the songwriters, right? So that's screwed
up,
too.
For
radio play. Terrestrial, what they call terrestrial radio play. So that's out of balance, too. So what I've been trying to do is get, like, let's pay the performers on terrestrial radio and let's even this thing out in the digital world, you know. But there was some people say that there was a rationale that because songwriters were paid on terrestrial in order to even it out, you had to give the performer the record, well, not even the performer, give the record label a bigger share when it comes to digital.
Well, the weird thing is that it's all an indication that the paradigms are kind of crumbling.
Mm-hmm.
And that they're desperately trying to protect whatever investment they seem to think is getting away from them. And that means cutting out the artist somehow.
Right, exactly. And we wouldn't have put up with it in the old days, and we shouldn't have put it up with it.
Well, now it's more confusing because, like, the weird thing about the old days is that, you know, a record's a record. So now if something goes online in whatever form it's going to go online, it's like, how does an artist even protect themselves? How do they employ? You got to employ a lawyer. You got to figure out who you're going to fucking sue.
It's impossible.
Right.
Unless you're with a label, and then you can have these large arrays of computers that run around and automatically file these notices and send or cut deals with people like SoundCloud and stuff like that.
So if you're an independent artist, you're on your own, and you have to make the exception. It's sort of like, well, if the payoff is people know who we are,
right? Yeah, which, you know,
but that's the scam they run on you because we live in this medium.
Yeah,
the hunger for content. A human being can't keep up for the hunger for content. So so free content is great for them, and they'll try and sell you on the idea that it's good promotional use.
Right.
So you sign off on this shit, and your song gets out there in the equivalent of being a hit song 20 years ago, and you get nothing because you're like, it's good. It was for promotion.
Right. Exactly.
It's a fucking racket.
It is a racket, and these companies that make the money off of it are even bigger than the record labels. I mean, they're even more powerful, you know? They're lobbyists running around in D.C.
And
changing laws and stuff like that to make
them... They own it.
Yeah.
The loser is the guy in his van with his friends and their guitars.
Right. Now, some artists do thrive in this environment, but it's the biggest artists. So so to me, it was weird is because... See, one of the things is that I was kind of a proponent of the... You know, it's like, when I first saw piracy, I was like, oh... You know, I saw Napster, I looked at that, I go, that's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But on the other hand, I was optimistic for a long time. I go, but, you know, I was on an indie label, but we could sell stuff directly to our fans now. So maybe we're just cutting out the middlemen.
Right.
And I think there was actually this period that that worked really well. And then...
It's worked well for me, but I'm not a musician.
Yeah, but yeah, you know, I mean...
There's no middleman.
And actually, in a weird way, it doesn't actually, like, for instance, it doesn't hurt Cracker as much as it hurts Camper Van Beethoven. Because Camper Van Beethoven really did sort of never really make much money on the road, and we sort of needed to come home and have the sale of those albums that we sold.
Right.
And whereas Cracker... Yeah, I mean, you know, every summer, you know, it's because we've had these songs that are recurrent on rock radio. I mean, I could spend the entire summer playing like the Wisconsin State Fair and the, you know, outside of the Del Mar racetrack on Wednesday nights, they'll have a popular 90s band play. You know, I could spend all summer doing that, you know, and make just as much as money as I was making in the 90s from the live side of things, right?
Because
we are ubiquitous. We worked on having some songs that were ubiquitous. Camper never really worked on being ubiquitous, right? And so it's we always needed those album sales and stuff like that. So it's a more difficult thing to manage that for the medium and smaller.
Sure,
acts
and you sort of got to rely on a reintroduction to Camper, and then
and you know, the other thing is like another what I think people don't understand about me is what I'm saying is like I made 98% of the money that I ever was going to make in the music business, and I was smart enough also to keep some of my technology chops and friends and stuff like that around. And like I actually have these, I've done really well, like doing like I'm on a board of an angel investment fund and a tech incubator and all that stuff. I actually kind of have my foot in my feet in this other world too, you know.
Yeah,
and it's like this doesn't make any monetarily, like if the, if we fix, you know, the way that songwriters are paid for streaming, that's really not going to change the view out my window, right?
Right. Yeah.
It is what it is for me.
But
now,
it's a fight worth fighting on some level.
Well, I just, I feel like there's a lot of people that I know that don't have the advantages that I have. And that was one of the things was I actually made some money on this technology company about, what was that, about 3 years ago. And one of the things I did is I actually put aside a little bit of money and I go, all right, nobody's gone out there and done this since Lars Ulrich.
So you're going to do it.
I'm going to go do this. I'm going to do this for 2 years and see what happens, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go around to all these conferences. I'm going to go to the tech conferences and say, hey, man, you guys are ripping us off, man. We got to fix this, right? And the predictable blowback happened. It's not for the, it wasn't for the, it's not for the weak, you know, to go and do that.
Right.
You know? I mean, it's like, you know, but I don't know. I feel like I made a difference. I feel like the debate has changed a little bit. People are thinking about this stuff. I mean, at least it's being discussed now.
Right.
And I ended up like getting in front of Congress and testifying in front of Congress. I mean, who was the last person to do it? Was like Zappa or what was it? The Twisted Sister guy? Didn't he get it? Who got up there? Like
Dee Snider and Frank
Snyder,
Zappa.
Yeah. You know, it's pretty funny.
So was it cool?
Yeah, it wasn't. It wasn't very much like.
It wasn't like the McCarthy hearing.
It wasn't like, no. It's just like a handful of reporters in a room in a, you know, it's the IP subcommittee. So it's not like the headliner committee.
Yeah,
you know, you're on the side stage.
Sure,
you know what I mean?
Right.
But yeah, it's pretty cool. You know, you're looking up there and you're seeing these. Actually, the weirdest thing is, you know, the guys who sort of get it the most are not always the, you know, it's not always the Democrats. You know, like people like Conyers and Mel Watt who have ties to like, some, well, you know,
business guys.
Yeah, you know, sometimes it's the, sometimes it's just as much the Republican guys that are coming over to you and going, yeah, you know, I get it. You're not asking for a handout. You just want what you deserved. Yeah, well, I can get behind that, you know.
Yeah, that's it. Well, that's good. And the support is good.
Yeah.
We'll see what happens.
Yeah.
So now these campers, so you took a decade off with Camper, basically, and now you guys you're all getting along and all is good.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, it's fantastic. You know, we talked about Jonathan not being on Key Lime Pie, but as soon as we played together, you know, Jonathan and I had started working on records, other people's records together, like in the mid-90s. I think we did some Sparkle Horse stuff and together, and so we've, you know, there was 5 or 6 years we didn't hang out, but you know, we've been sort of friends for a long time, and it's great to, you know, be back playing with Jonathan and Greg.
Why'd you guys record Tusk, the Fleetwood Mac record? I have to get a copy of that. I don't have it.
Okay, so Camper Van Beethoven really got back together in, say, 2001.
Yeah.
But we didn't really play any shows, but we decided we'd record together again. But we decided that what we would do is there's an album called Camper Van Beethoven is Dead, Long Live Camper Van Beethoven. And it's a fake Oddities record. We actually just kind of recorded it and pretended it like it was an Oddities record and dropped it out there.
Yeah.
It was like, very Kaufman. What band? I think we were probably influenced by Andy Kaufman, right? You know, it's like, let's put out a fake Oddities record as our new record. We just put it out there. It's like, okay. Oh, hey, we just discovered this, that we recorded Tusk in 1987 on our four track. We finally found the tapes for that. That wasn't true. We recorded that.
The whole album.
Yeah, the whole album, and then put it out as if it was like something that we had done in 1987 and just put out there.
Yeah.
Nobody noticed.
And you
so then finally we did a new album and then just like, hey, we're back together.
Yeah.
But we did two albums that were fake things from the catalog.
And nobody noticed?
Nobody noticed. But of course, we didn't really tell anybody, so I don't know how they were supposed to figure it out anyway.
Right.
So, you know, that's the kind of stuff that we enjoy doing.
I have to get hold of Tusk.
Yeah.
So you guys are touring on these records?
We're touring on these records. Not a huge number of shows. This one is, we did two halves. We did a Northern California version of Camper Van Beethoven, which is a little more hippiest. That's La Costa Perdida. We put that out last year. And then this year is the follow-up, which is El Camino Real.
That's Southern California?
That's Southern California, yes.
Great. Do you want to do a song?
Sure. What are we going to do, though? Is it from the new album?
Whatever you want.
Yeah. I was going to look at the words to something, but fuck it. Just haven't really played this. You know, a new album, it's funny about when you make new albums, you know? It's like, there's a... You got to learn to sing all those words. You add, like, I've got like several hundred songs right now, and then you add like another 15 on top of it, right? It's like, yeah, thanks. I really needed that. So, here you go. It's from there. 400 miles down the Mexican coast. I'm $200 from being flat broke. Surf seven sisters all day long, drinking mezcal when the sun goes down. I was like a grasshopper sitting on a vine. Along come a señorita, say you're mine. Venga gringo, where you gotta go? You can stay with me just on down the road. Kissing her lips and rolling on the beach. Baby, stay here, work for family. Down the coast there's a landing strip. My brother's got a plane, you can work for him. Oh Lord, let me live for one more day. I'll be a good boy the rest of my days. Oh Lord, if you get me out of this place, I'll never stray from the straight and narrow way. Oh Lord, if you give me one small sign, I'll be a good boy the rest of my life, for the rest of my life. Fat grasshopper on a sweet potato vine. Saw me coming for miles. Gringo surfers from Northern Canada. We fly them down to Punta Negra. Got a baby girl and she looks like mom. Black curly hair and the devil's smile. Federales know what we take up north. Lord, let me live till I'm old and gray. Oh Lord, if you live for one more day, I'll be a good boy the rest of my days. Oh Lord, if you take me out of this place, I'll never trip from the straight and narrow way. Oh Lord, if you give give me one small sign. I'll be a good boy the rest of my life, for the rest of my life. For the rest of my life.
Awesome, man. Thanks so much for doing this.
No problem, man. Thanks for having me.
That's it. That's our show. I enjoyed that. Nice. Nice hearing that dude sing. Nice talking to him. Oh, boy. Wonder if I'm going to hear from any of those people that I live with in Somerville. Look, go to WTFpod.com. Check out everything there. Get the app. Upgrade. Get the free app. Upgrade to the premium app. You can stream all 500 million shows. What else? You can leave some comments if you want to. You can get some merch. Going to get some more mugs up there. I'm going to try and tell you guys about those special ceramic mugs before I put it on Twitter. Remind me to do that. Would somebody remind me to do that? What else? What else is happening? Oh, the Tripany House. Tripany.org. Tripany House at the Steve Allen Theater. I'll be doing shows there on November 11th and November 18th. And I'm writing my show. And and secretly having fantasies about just starting a band. What would that band be, though? Come on, man! Boomer lives!
Robinhood bietet Ihnen Zugang zum US-Aktienmarkt. Sie können Krypto zu niedrigen Kosten kaufen und verkaufen. Alles an einem Ort. Auf Robinhood. Investment- und Kryptowertedienstleistungen für EU-Kunden werden von der Robinhood Europe UAB angeboten, die von der Zentralbank Litauens als Finanzmakler und Kryptowertedienstleister zugelassen ist und deren Aufsicht unterliegt. Termingeschäfte auf US-Aktien und ETF-Token bergen ein erhebliches Risiko und sind nicht für alle Anleger geeignet. Bitte überlegen Sie sich sorgfältig, ob Investments in derartige Finanzinstrumente mit Blick auf Ihre Erfahrung, Risikotoleranz und Finanzlage für Sie geeignet sind. Beachten Sie die geltenden Beschränkungen und Zulassungsvoraussetzungen.